Okay, we have come to the end of our study in the book of Genesis, our very last lesson tonight, covering chapters 46 through 50. Anytime you cover five chapters that have this much detail, it's a pretty big challenge, but we'll do the best we can. I wanted us to very briefly review the book of Genesis. We can't really do a very extensive review with all that we've else that we've got to cover. But as we kind of look through the different periods of Bible history, and there are various ways, of course, that people break that down, but the way that we've typically done it here, we cover four of those periods just within the book of Genesis. First of all, we have before the flood. We have, of course, the story of creation there in chapter 1, the first sin, chapters 2 and 3, the story of Cain and Abel, chapter 4, and then the generations of Adam, taking us from Adam all the way to Noah, there in chapter 5. And then, of course, the monumental event there in chapter 6 and 9, the flood. And then that's followed by, of course, the scattering of the people in chapters 10 and 11. You have the generations of Noah in chapter 10. You have, of course, a list of the descendants of Shem and Ham and Japheth. And then, of course, you have this Tower of Babel, where God scatters the people, and you see the people going all over the face of the earth and the development of the different nations and so forth. But then the writer focuses on one of the sons of Noah in particular. We have the lineage of Shem. And as we talked about in previous studies, just an ordinary human historian would not know, of course, to begin to focus on this one line. How would he know that this one line would have so much significance? And the fact of the matter is, he wouldn't, unless he was given divine guidance. And one of the things that I'll say just about the book of Genesis as a whole is, if read honestly by someone, if it's read honestly and objectively, it will make a believer out of you. And I'm not necessarily suggesting that that would be the first place I would go in discussing things with an unbeliever, but there are things within this book that are powerful and very convicting. And so I would encourage us to look at it from that standpoint. And then, of course, we have the patriarchs. We have the stories in pretty extensive detail of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph there in chapters 12 through 50. And, of course, the crux of all of it is those promises that were first made to Abraham. Remember, we identified really six promises made to him, but it really kind of comes down to three major ones, right? I will make of you a great nation. I will give that nation a land. And in your seed, in your descendant, all nations of the earth will be blessed. And then, of course, those same promises get repeated later to Isaac and then also to Jacob. And what have we said about those three promises? The rest of the Bible records the fulfillment of those three promises. So it's important to really have a good grasp on those. And we see that beginning to develop, you know, somewhat here within the book of Genesis. Let's talk about that plan of redemption, at least what we have revealed to us in the book of Genesis. First of all, why is there even a need for redemption?
Separation from God.
Yeah. Right there at the beginning of the book, we see what happens in the Garden of Eden. Of course, the sin. And what is the consequence of that sin?
Death.
Yeah. And what happens to Adam and Eve stay in the garden? No more, right? They're driven out of the garden and to make sure that they don't have access to that tree of life that is found in the garden, what does God do? Yeah, you got the flaming sword guarding the way to the tree of life. And so we've got an issue. We've got some separation here. We've got this, we had this ideal state in the Garden of Eden, and that is no more. And so, of course, the rest of the Bible is about trying to restore man to that state. Hence the need for redemption. Obviously, when we keep going a little bit further in the book of Genesis, we see that downward spiral of humanity. We saw that in chapter 6 where the sons of God married the daughters of men, and saw what an impact that had on the morality of people and so forth. And so God starts over, right? Destroys the earth with a flood. Starts over with those eight souls. Problem taken care of, right? We don't have any sin anymore after that. Is that correct? Have we seen any sin in the book of Genesis? Oh yeah. There is this great need. That's the great need of man. Redemption from sin. So again, let's look very quickly at it. We know that as far as this one who is going to come, and that's what the rest of the Bible is primarily about, he will be a descendant of Eve. He will be born of woman. He will come and he will defeat Satan, according to chapter 3 and verse 15. He will bless all families of the earth. That's that seed promise, that spiritual promise in Genesis 12 and verse 3. He will also reign. He will have a scepter. That we learn from Genesis 49 and verse 10 when Jacob is blessing his 12 sons. Remember what was said of Judah? In fact, let's look at that very quickly. Genesis 49 and verse 10. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. Now, there are people who would dispute the messianic nature of this, but good luck with that. That to me is, there's just no way around the fact that this is a messianic promise, and especially when we see what's revealed later. Jesus the Christ will come from the tribe of Judah, specifically from the family of David. He certainly will reign, and all people will be subject to him, or at least that will be the demand on people. And then, of course, we also notice that he will come through the line of Eve, as we've already said, through Abraham, through Isaac, through Jacob, and now, as we learn in our lesson tonight, through Judah. Of course, that will be developed some more as we go forward in our Old Testament study. Well, anything else, just in the way of overview, review, or anything like that before we move forward? Alright, let's get into chapters 46 through 50. We'll just kind of keep doing as we've done the last several weeks, just sort of retell the story here. And maybe pause a few times and highlight certain things. Alright, where did we leave off in chapter 45? What invitation has Pharaoh extended to Jacob and his family? Yeah, come to Egypt, right? And we'll find a little corner over here and put y'all kind of, you know, in the spare bedroom, so to speak. Is that the idea? Yeah, you're going to get the best of the land. We're going to put you in the land of Goshen. You know, we're going to take care of you, provide for you in the best possible way. So that's where we left off at the end of chapter 45. So Israel, or Jacob, left Hebron. That's kind of where he had settled, going back to chapter 35 and verse 27. And he came to Beersheba. He's on his journey toward Egypt, and he stops there in Beersheba, where he offered sacrifices to God. God, at this time, there in Beersheba, spoke some very reassuring words to him. He said, "Do not fear to go down to Egypt. I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will bring you up again. And Joseph will put his hand on your eyes." Now, what's that all about? Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. Yeah, talking about his death, right? Yeah, closing the eyes. Does that happen? Yeah, he's right there the time that he does. Alright, so Jacob arose from Beersheba, and he and all his descendants headed toward Egypt. Remember those wagons that Pharaoh had sent back? You know, the sons of Israel carried Jacob, their little ones, and their wives in the wagons that Pharaoh had sent to them. Would it be fair to say that Pharaoh has gone above and beyond in providing for Joseph's family?
Sure.
Yeah. Was Joseph highly thought of by Pharaoh? Is he highly thought of by you? I kind of like him, don't you? Yeah, absolutely. There's some great qualities found Somebody had their hand up.
Yeah. So when he tells Jacob to go down to Joseph and put his hands over his eyes, is that leading more to that's where the promise is to go? You know, instead of going to Reuben, Joseph's going to be the one to do that job instead of the brother. Is there anything to that?
Well, I mean, obviously the birthright is going to go to Joseph instead of Reuben or to any of the other brothers. I don't know that there's an indication there. I think it's just this whole idea of how, you know, he thought he would never see Joseph. He thought he was dead. And, you know, not only are you going to see him, he'll be there at the time of your death. That's what I get out of it anyway. Okay. And then we kind of have sort of a pause in the narrative there in chapter 46, verses 8 through 27. We've got Jacob's family listed there, grouped under the mothers. You got Leah's six children, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and the grandchildren listed. There's a total of 33 in that particular number. Then you've got Zilpah's children, Gad and Asher, and the grandchildren, 16 total. And you've got Rachel's children, Joseph, Benjamin, and the grandchildren, which of course would be 14. And then Bilhah's, left the H out there, sorry about that. Bilhah's children, Dan and Naphtali, the grandchildren. Of course, the total of those children and grandchildren amounted to 7. So we got a total of how many? All right, we got 70. Now, Ur and Onan, children of Judah, are listed here. But what about them? They didn't make it to Canaan, did they? What happened to them? Yeah, God killed them because of their wickedness. They are listed, though, in this 70. But anyway, just kind of wanted to point out that, you know, among that 70, you have these two that didn't make it. In Acts 7, Stephen talks about 75 leaving and going to Egypt. Here's what I'll do about that. I'll let you research that, why there's a difference in 70 and 75. There's a good explanation for it, but we're not going to go into all of that today. But I'll let you do some research on that. All right, so Jacob sent Judah ahead. Remember now, they're on their way to Egypt. They've got Jacob and the little ones and all loaded up on the wagons. And Jacob sent Judah ahead to get directions from Joseph to the land of Goshen. When Jacob and his family arrived, Joseph went to greet him. Let's just pause a minute and just kind of try to imagine. Gone all these years thinking that he was dead. Just try to imagine the emotion of it. He fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. Jacob said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face, because you are still alive." And we use expressions like that sometimes, right? Boy, if I die today, you know, I'd be the happiest man on the earth. You know, just, you know, this is, you know, beyond my wildest dreams and wishes to be able to see you alive. Joseph then said to his family, "I will tell Pharaoh you have come, that you are shepherds and keepers of cattle, and that you have brought your flocks and herds. Now when Pharaoh asks your occupation, say, 'Well, we are shepherds,' because shepherds are an abomination to Egyptians." Now,
why
are they
an abomination?
Why are they?
I'm going to try to look that word up.
Does anybody know? Lamar?
I don't know why the Egyptians didn't care for shepherds, but I know that there was a very good purpose fulfilled in the fact that the Egyptians viewed them that way.
Right.
It kept them a separate people,
right,
and it prepared them for what God had in mind a lot of years later.
Yeah, think about what we have had develop here in the latter part of the book of Genesis. You know, obviously, going back to the promises originally made to Abraham, "I will make of you a great nation." There's going to be a lot of folks. They're going to come from you. Okay. And then, of course, I'm going to give that nation a land and so forth. But, okay, now, we've got them in a situation now in a good part of the land where they can prosper, where they can grow exceedingly. Okay? They're well taken care of. You know, they can become this multitude of people like God had promised. But not only that, to be kept as a separate people, as Lamar said. You know, when you first read this, you think, why would they want to be an abomination to these Egyptians that have taken... Well, again, I think Lamar is right about the reason behind it.
Well, too, we talked a week or two ago, I think, about the rulers of Egypt at the time. They were the Hyksos people. They were the ones that invaded.
Would that have been cattle, though, specifically, and not sheep, perhaps? Yeah. I don't know. I have questions. I had thought about the same thing that you just mentioned. That's one thought, at least, that came from that. All right, so Joseph... Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say they're okay with cattle.
Yeah, right, cattle are fine. Exactly. So Joseph went and told Pharaoh that his father's family, along with their flocks and herds, we're now in the land of Goshen. So we're kind of setting up the meeting that Joseph had already talked to them about. Okay, you know, you're going to meet up with him, and when he asks you this question, you know what to say. Joseph took five brothers with him. Pharaoh said to the brothers, "What is your occupation?" The five brothers answered, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers." In other words, we didn't just start doing this. It's been going on for a while, right? This has kind of been the family business for some time. They further said to Pharaoh, "We have come here to live because we have no pasture for our flocks and because the famine is severe in Canaan. Please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen." Anything strike you as just a tad bit odd about that request? Pharaoh had already said that, right? It had been made clear that this would be their land. Come to the. So why would they say that?
They were shepherds. They were loathed.
And I don't know that I know for sure, but when you're talking to someone of this magnitude, you don't take things for granted, do you? You know, in other words, you don't come in there like, "All right, you already said this. We're going to jump over here and we're going to take what you've already said as ours." No, you're still very gracious in the way you make this request. And, I mean, at least that's the idea.
But who did Pharaoh tell that? Did he tell that to Joseph? Not all the brothers?
Yeah, but I think the message is, if I remember correctly, I think the message has already been communicated to them, though. Now, you'd have to double check me on that. I mean, it's a good question, but yeah. All right, Pharaoh answered, speaking to Joseph in particular, "Let them dwell in the best of the land in Goshen. If you know any able men among them, put them in charge of my cattle." That's what Philip was alluding to earlier. So perhaps a difference there in the choice of livestock. Joseph then brought his father Jacob before Pharaoh. After Jacob blessed him, Pharaoh asked him how old he was. Jacob's answer was, "Well, my pilgrimage has been 130 years. Hard and difficult years. And not as many as attained by my fathers." Jacob again blessed Pharaoh and then left his presence. Keep asking the same question, but anything strike you as a little unusual about that?
Jacob blessed Pharaoh.
Yeah. Lamar, what have we learned in Hebrews about this blessed deal?
Would assume you're talking about the greater plus and the lesser. The lesser, or the lesser, you know, how that falls.
Yeah. I don't know. Perhaps there are exceptions to that. I don't know if that's a universal rule in every single case among all peoples everywhere, but I don't know. It just kind of was interesting to me anyway. I don't want to make too much about that. But of course, then Joseph situated his family just as Pharaoh had said there in the land of Goshen and provided them bread. So again, they're in a situation that is so very conducive for them to be able to multiply and to prosper just as God wanted them to. Now, I guess this should go without saying, but as we kind of go back through the book of Genesis and how everything unfolded to get them to this point, isn't it amazing how God works it out perfectly for His people, puts them in the very best situation, despite the sins of people, despite their connivings and so forth. And so, you know, God's had to work through a lot of the failures of man to bring all of this about. But that doesn't stop Him. Yeah, you know, just how amazing and powerful He is. Joseph sold grain to the Egyptians. Remember now, we're still in the midst of those famine years, very severe famine. Joseph sold grain to the Egyptians until all the money was in the hands of Pharaoh. Well, we've got a problem now. The Egyptians come to Joseph and say, well, give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money is failed. We've dried up as far as the money is concerned. Well, the solution that Joseph proposed was he gave them bread in exchange for their horses and their flocks and their herds. Well, what happens then? Run out of bread again, right? Again, this is very indicative of how severe that famine was. So now they say, well, our money is gone. Our Lord has our livestock. We've nothing left but our bodies and lands. Buy us and our land for bread, and we'll be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed then, so that we can live and the land not be desolate. So it's just kind of having to come up with different ways to solve this problem. So Joseph bought all the land for Pharaoh, except for that which belonged to the priests, because he gave them a regular allowance. He resettled the people from one end of Egypt to the other, and Joseph said to the people, here is seed for you to plant. You will give one-fifth of the harvest to Pharaoh, and the rest will be yours. The text even tells us that this fifth being given to Pharaoh became a law. And I believe there's some significance to that. Because it'd be pretty easy, wouldn't it, for another Pharaoh to come in and do what? At least take more than a bit, you know. But I just thought that was significant. This became a law. In other words, you're going to be limited to this much. You have saved our lives, he said. We will please you and be servants to Pharaoh. So we see Joseph continuing to administer over this famine situation. And then it says that the Israelites grew and multiplied exceedingly in Goshen. Isn't that the way it was supposed to work? Yeah, absolutely. Jacob lived in Egypt 17 years before he died at 147. Remember, he was 130 when he came there before Pharaoh. Joseph swore that he would bury him with his ancestors. Now, it's already talking about his death at 147 years, but he's not dead yet. Who was it? Will Rogers said reports of my demise are greatly exaggerated. But anyway, we'll see some more before he actually dies. All right, so we move into chapter 48. After these burial arrangements were made, Joseph heard his father was sick. So he took Ephraim and Manasseh to be blessed by him. Of course, Ephraim and Manasseh were his two sons. When Jacob heard Joseph was coming, he strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. You'd probably do the same thing, wouldn't you? no matter how weak, tired, and sick you were. You know, if your son's coming, your grandchildren are coming, that get a little strength up at that point, right? Jacob says to Joseph, God appeared to me at Luz, or Bethel. What does Bethel mean, by the way? You either remember it from the study or you remember it from Joshua's lesson.
House of God.
House of God, right? Okay. Going back all the way to chapter 28. Joseph appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. He said, I will make you a multitude of people and give this land to your descendants. And we keep, continual references back to those promises. Your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in Egypt, are mine. Just as Reuben and Simeon are mine. They shall be mine. Continuing, Jacob said, any other sons you have will be yours. They will be considered part of either Ephraim or Manasseh. To my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan, just a little distance from Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, remember now, his eyesight's pretty dim, so he knows some people are standing over here. He couldn't tell a whole lot about them, but who are these? Joseph said, well, these are my sons, whom God has given me in this place. Jacob said, well, please bring them to me, and I will bless them. Israel's eyes were dim, so Joseph brought them near, and Israel kissed them and embraced them. So we've got it all set up now for Jacob to bless these two sons of Joseph. Israel said, I thought I would never see your face. Now God has also shown me your offspring. I never thought I would see you again, much less see your children like I am right now. So he's just really overcome with emotion. Joseph took them from Israel's embrace and bowed down with his face to the earth. He moved his two sons near Jacob, with Manasseh the oldest on his father's right hand. And so Joseph got them arranged, like he thinks it ought to be, okay? Manasseh being the oldest, I'll have him over here by my dim-sighted father, his right hand, and he'll be able to put his hand on it. But as Israel reached out, he crossed his hands so that his right hand was on Ephraim and his left on Manasseh. Israel then blessed Joseph and his two sons. Someone read Hebrews 11 in verse 21. Hebrews 11 in verse 21. I don't want to keep your place here. That not referring to this particular instance, blessing each of the two sons of Joseph. So how did he do that by faith? How did Jacob know which one to bless? He obviously reverses what was typical. How does he know? Yeah. Or he's given him some sort of revelation, right? The whole idea of faith would be. Yeah. But would he have done it by faith? Would it have been by faith if God was forcing his hand in one direction as opposed to another? Would that be by faith? Lamar?
I wasn't going to answer when he asked the question about which son got the blessing because both sons were blessed. And I've always read this to take it that he knew there was a reason for them to be blessed, that there was a future for the children of Israel. But they're not in captivity yet, but they're not. a place where the promises would be fulfilled.
Right.
And I think I've always read it to mean that the faith that was demonstrated was that there's more that's going to happen, and the promises would be fulfilled, and these sons would be involved in that
right.
fulfillment of that blessing.
Right. And how in the world, though, does he know that Ephraim will be greater than Manasseh? I mean, it's one thing to say, well, okay, there are still yet things to happen, and my children will be involved in that, and it's not going to take place in this land, it's going to be in another. You know, all that had been revealed, but how does he know that Ephraim is going to be great?
Well, the passage
of
Hebrews said he did this by faith. Faith comes by hearing the word of God.
Yeah.
Somewhere, somehow, he's been revealed.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, you know, back to what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, Jacob absolutely knows what he's doing. Let's just continue through here. Joseph, of course, tried to get his father to switch his hands, putting his right on Manasseh instead. Hold on, Dad. Let me, you know, put the hand over here in the right one. Well, here's Jacob's response. I know, my son, I know. He knew exactly what he was doing. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. That is speaking of Manasseh. But his younger brother will be greater, and his descendants will become a multitude of nations. The northern kingdom, later on in history, when you know that united kingdom led by Saul and David and Solomon splits, you have the divided kingdom. You have the kingdom of Israel in the north and the kingdom of Judah in the south. The kingdom of Israel was often called what? At least in the prophets. Ephraim. Why would the northern kingdom be referred to often as Ephraim? Oh, yeah. It was absolutely the predominant tribe. It dominated the others. And I think this is looking ahead to that time, that Ephraim would be so much greater. So, as the text said, Israel set Ephraim before Manasseh. Israel then said to Joseph, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. I have given you one portion above your brother, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and bow. What? When in the world did that happen? The land which I took from the Amorite? What land had he taken from the Amorites?
The Amorites still occupied that land
Yeah. When would the land be given to Abraham's descendants? When what was full? When the iniquity of the Amorites is full. That's when they would come in with swords and take the land. Now this is spoken of as if it had already happened, right? But when you're talking about God, and this kind of gets back to what Bob was saying just a minute ago, it's treated as a done deal. It's going to be many years before this happens, but I think that's exactly what it's referring to. You know, they're going to come in and take that land by sword, but again, that's going to be later on when you know they will be punished for their iniquity. All right, moving into chapter 49. Jacob blesses and makes prophecies concerning his sons. Now, these are highly interesting, and I would urge you to read them carefully, looking for things that are fulfilled later on. We sure don't have time to go through all of that tonight. When Jacob finished blessing his sons, he said, I am about to die. Bury me with my fathers in the cave of Machpelah in the field of Ephron the Hittite, which Abraham bought for a burial place. We read about that earlier in Genesis, right? There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah, Isaac and his wife Rebekah, and there I buried Rachel. After giving his sons this charge, Jacob drew his feet up into the bed and breathed his last. All right, we get here toward the end, chapter 50. Joseph embraced his father's dead body, wept over him, and kissed him. He then commanded his physician servants to embalm him 40-day process. It says the Egyptians mourned Jacob's death for 70 days. Joseph sought permission to bury his father in the land of Canaan, which is, of course, according to his request, which Pharaoh granted. Joseph was accompanied by Egyptian dignitaries, kind of, you know, specifies who these folks were, and his own family, and they were escorted by chariots and horsemen. I think the text says it was a great company that gathered together and took this trip. Quite a funeral procession, right? They went up the east side of the Jordan, and when they came to the threshing floor of Atad, they mourned 7 days for Jacob. I use a little restraint in how I word that. What does the text actually say? As far as the mourning was concerned. They just cried a few tears, right? Yeah, it was a great lamentation they made over Jacob. And a lot of respect being shown for him. And you have to think that by this time, of course, Jacob had lived 17 years in the land of Egypt, but some of this, too, would be sort of a byproduct of the great respect that the people had for Joseph as well. The Canaanites observed this mourning and said, "This is a deep mourning of the Egyptians." I mean, this was something that struck them. You got to keep in mind now, in this part of the world, and you see this throughout Scripture, the great lamentation and mourning was something very much characteristic of many of these cultures. But this was different. Even this was different. This is something else. So they played, the place was called Abel Mizraim, or the mourning of Egypt. So it was something that really stood out to them. Jacob's sons did for him just what he asked. They buried him in the cave of Machpelah. And when they were finished, they returned to Egypt. Okay, now we've got Jacob dead, and the brothers get a little concerned, right? They feared he might try now to repay the evil they did to him. So they sent messengers to Joseph saying, "Before your father died, he told us to ask you to forgive us. So please forgive our trespass." Did Jacob tell him that? My inkling is that they made this up. But, Lynn asked me something last week. I forgot now a specific question she asked me. But I said, well, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, something that they had claimed, I'll give them the benefit of it. And maybe it's best to do that. But there's obviously no record of him saying that. That doesn't mean that he didn't. His brothers then went themselves to Joseph. You know, they sent the messengers first, but they went to Joseph themselves. They fell down before his face and said, "Behold, we are your servants." Joseph said, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You meant evil against me, but God meant for good, to save many people alive. So don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." It says he spoke, or he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Joseph lived 110 years, long enough to see Ephraim's great-grandchildren, say to the third generation there, and Manasseh's grandchildren, Rebekah. Well, he got to see a whole lot more than he ever thought that he would. Before he died, he said this to his family, "I am dying. God will visit you and bring you out of this land to the land he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Joseph then took an oath from them saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here." Well, we read Hebrews 11:21 a few minutes ago, right? Hebrews 11:22 talks about Joseph giving command concerning his bones. By faith he gave this command. And he knows that the future is not here. He died at the age of 110. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. All right, any other comments or questions? Joshua, go ahead.
One thing that makes Genesis so amazing is not only the specific promises and prophecies about the Messiah, but all the types that are represented. We go stand between sacrifice of Isaac in Genesis 22. Yeah. But in this, I mean, you have somebody who, in a sense, died and came back to life, prepared a place for his brothers. You have echoes of the Father forgive them, they don't know what they do. And so, as much as those prophecies of Christ are significant, it's the types that are foreshadowed.
Yeah, and of course, sometimes, you know, people will look at types and so forth, and they'll say, yeah, but maybe some of these people were aware of prophecies and they played it out. So, no way that's going to be the case here, you know, for anybody that might take a real skeptical view of that sort of thing. Chip, go ahead.
It strikes me, too, when Joseph's brothers got killed again, his reaction, did he will. Thinking about for all these years, they lived like this in fear and wonder and no resolution to it. I don't know how many years it's been, but you can help you at least 20, because of Jacob's age and his death, 17 years, I think it's at least 20 years in there.
I think we determined it was 20 last year, but or last week. But yeah. Oh yeah. Anything else? All right. We'll end it right there.